The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Extra before the lockdown. So as expected, UEFA moved the Euros to 2021. Good news for Kane, bad news for Ronaldo. At the same meeting, a commitment to finish all the domestic leagues and European competitions by the end of June. How hopeful to commit to something you can't possibly commit to. The financial impact is already being felt as Barnett let 60 non-playing staff go. Is there the will or the means for money at the top to filter down to the bottom? What's happening in Italy? Nicky Bandini joins us. The A-League continues in Australia. We'll speak to the Guardian's man over there. It's the start of our brand new Corona Positivity Corner. And thank you for still listening and for sending so many questions that we have enough content to keep us going until the end of humanity, which could well be the weekend. All that on today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Jonathan Liu, how are you doing?
Not great.
No?
I mean, I'm not really sure why we're here, to be honest. It's kind of weird and strange to be, you know, walking through a ghostly city to, you know, past people who are clearly doing very valuable and worthwhile jobs to come and talk about, you know, A-League football and whether Phil Foden has a better chance of making Euro 2021 than Euro 2020.
Do you not see us as essential workers?
No, I've been trying to argue this to our daughter's nursery, which is closing on Friday, except for key workers, that sports satirist for a newspaper does in fact count as a vital public service. I'll let you know how that goes.
Jonathan Wilson.
Morning.
Barry Glendenning.
Hello.
Sam says, at the moment, the Guardian Football Weekly podcast is like that radio station that kept playing the metronome during the siege of Leningrad in 1943. Please don't stop, even if there is no football for a while. And Dom says, what key skills do you each bring to the table in a post-apocalyptic society? After the coming fall of global capitalism, what useful worker roles would the state assign you, do you think? I can't imagine a more useless set of people, actually. Barry, what are you bringing to the table?
I'm good at chopping wood. You know, I used to do that a lot when I was a kid.
Pretty, I mean, no offence, but...
Pretty handy with an axe.
How's your stamina in that regard?
Well, I would need to work on it. I haven't done it for quite some time, but I quite like chopping wood. It's quite relaxing and therapeutic.
What's the tactic?
Well, you just... put one bit of wood on top of another bit of wood and hit it with an axe.
I see. Okay. Wilson, any advances on chopping some wood?
Well, I'm a reasonable cook, I think. Not, I mean, nothing fancy, but in terms of, you know, hearty, filling, nourishing food, I'm
Sam himself. Allardyce of the cooking world, would you say?
I mean, Sam Allardyce, I think, he'd have gone for, like, the sous vide very early. You know, he liked his innovations. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would watch a cooking show with Sam Allardyce and Samuel Lee.
Samuel Lee just applauding behind.
Just like eyes peering over the bench.
Johnny Liu, what are you bringing to the table?
I don't know. I can recite every FA Cup winner since the Second World War.
Oh, well, that's a pod we're going to do. save that for a couple of weeks' time.
We did that in a bar opposite the Gare du Nord the day that England lost to Iceland.
Yeah.
When we thought that was a dark time.
First question.
And you, Max, what are you bringing to this apocalyptic party?
Grade 8 clarinet.
Well, we need some entertainment.
Video yourself on a balcony. The only person who played music instrument hasn't already done that.
Cuckoo says, does football matter?
In the cosmic scheme of things, no, not at all. But people really enjoy it. It provides a lot of employment for a lot of people. It provides a lot of entertainment for a lot of people. So in that regard, yes, it is important. But as I say, in the cosmic scheme of things, no, it could scarcely be less important.
You wrote a piece about this in the week, didn't you?
Yeah, I think I've probably done about two or three already about how you know, football or sport, it doesn't matter at all, but it matters just enough to justify me writing this piece. I think it will matter a bit more as time goes on. I honestly couldn't care less about it at the moment. But I think you can't just, you know, we're all sort of on lockdown in our houses for the next 6 months. We can't just be thinking, oh, I wonder how many people died today. So there will be a place, I think, for for something like this.
Mm. Yeah, I've written sort of Fisher-Price version of your Does Football Matter piece, and just quite astonishing how quickly it has unravelled. That's what I actually thinking about 2 weeks ago, what my day was, and I, you know, did the radio show previewing a big weekend of sport. I played in a semi-final, and then I went to Twickenham to watch England-Wales. Mm. And just the thought that no one can tell me, or I have no idea when I could possibly do any of those things, is weird, and it's changed so quickly.
Yeah, it's a symbolic importance of what it means as and when football returns. You're going back to that first game will be a hugely emotional thing for everybody, whether you're going as a journalist, whether you're going as a fan, or just, you know, being able to play football again. That is a sign of normality returning. And also, what have I done this week? I've watched a huge number of YouTube videos of Sunderland in the late 90s. So that seems to be the thing that I'm clinging to. Mm. That's the sort of
Kevin Phillips is getting you through this difficult time.
I tell you, Niall Quinn scored some brilliant goals. You forget. You think of him as just being a target man, but his chest control, his volleying. There's a goal he scores at Crystal Palace. Absolutely remarkable goal. A goal he scores against Luton as well. It's a very deft volley.
The best goal he ever scored in his life was in a hurling match for the Dublin Miners.
I was reading an interview with Kevin Phillips, an old interview with Kevin Phillips this week in 442 magazine, where he talks about the Howard Wilkinson grasping the nettle moment. Are you aware of this?
No.
I think it's in their relegation season, and Howard Wilkinson's in the dressing room, and he's a Tesco bag, and everyone's like, what's he got in this bag? And he's got a nettle in it. And he said, like, we have to grasp the nettle, lads. Who's going to grasp the nettle? And he literally puts his hand in the bag and grasps the nettle. They did get relegated that season.
I think I remember in Scouts being told, if you grasp the nettle with conviction, it doesn't hurt. And if you're a bit sort of reticent, all the stings sting you.
Right.
But I seem to remember going at it with what I thought was conviction.
It's a risk, isn't it?
It is a risk. And, you know, there were no dock leaves close by. Anyway, right, UEFA 2020 has been moved forward by 364 days to start on the 11th of June 2021. The move is obviously to avoid the worst of this outbreak, but also give individual leagues a fighting chance of finishing their season. The plan is to keep all of the arrangements with the cities and venues the same, but that will be flexible depending on each country's situation. The Women's Euros will most likely be postponed, but they haven't confirmed that. They've also announced new dates for the finals of the Europa League and the Champions League, the 24th and the 27th of June, respectively. The Copa America has been pushed back a year to the same dates as the Euros. Do we think this is a sensible thing to have done?
I mean, it's a reasonable first step. I think postponing the Euros was essential. I don't think there's any other option with that. I'd be very surprised if a Champions League happens in Istanbul on the 27th of June. I mean, Turkey's, I think, just had its second death yesterday. In as far as you can sort of trust official statistics there, it's only just beginning the process. So I think the idea that Turkey will be ready by the end of June is slightly fanciful, but I guess you have to put a date down while you work out what's going on.
It's obviously a very difficult situation. We're often very cynical, Johnny, about football administrators, but they have to do something, don't they?
I don't know if they do, really. Do the people of Europe, do the people of the world need to hear from football administrators right now? Is that what we should be encouraging people to listen to? I don't know. I mean, maybe it does give people a bit of comfort in this dark time to know that, that the fixtures that they were looking forward to watching and the tournaments they were looking forward to following, are going to happen at some specified date. But I don't really think there was any need to do this now. I don't think this is a time for football administrators or football clubs to do anything except, show a little bit of solidarity and say, look, we're not going to organise anything yet. We're not thinking about when this tournament is going to happen. We're going to be quiet for a bit.
Mm. Where football authorities had to sort of do something is say what happens to people whose contracts expire on the 30th of June, because they're clearly going to be placed in a hugely difficult position. So there has to be some thought as to what you do with that, whether you make special provisions to extend those by 6 months or just what happens. And I guess then the issue of when fixtures might be played is sort of a corollary to that. I think any any worker at the minute in whatever industry would like some kind of sense of security and some kind of knowledge of you know, whether they're going to keep on getting paid and you know, when their contract may run out. So I think from that point of view, the football authorities did have to act. I guess from UEFA's point of view, the dream scenario, which will not happen, is that they can get this season finished by the 30th of June, and that isn't an issue. But
once you get into this thing of where there's legal implications, and people will say, oh, footballers, you know, they're minted, they'll be all right. But a lot of footballers earn fairly, you know, average money. And if they're out of contract in June, then agents get involved. You know, if the Football League or the FA were to agree to, you know, you can just do week by week rolling contracts until such time as football is back to normal, the agents could, you know, use that as leverage, and it could get very messy. Ideally, you'd want everyone to, you know, pull together and do what's right, but this is football and it's a cutthroat business.
Did you see what happened with the French Open tennis, where they essentially they postponed and said, look, right, we're rescheduling it, and they just sort of grabbed 2 weeks in the calendar. I think it's sort of September, which is right after the US Open. And I wonder if obviously they were like the US Open were extremely critical about that, and a lot, you know, a lot of tennis players as well. But I wonder if that's going to be what we see over the next few weeks or months, that if the calendar is all up in the air and it's just a total free for all, whether people are just going to start grabbing bits of the calendar and say, right, we're going to host our event here, and the whole, you know, the whole scheduling of sport is sort of is kind of a bit of a, you know, land grab at the moment.
And there's this interesting situation with the FAI and Mick McCarthy and Stephen Kenny. Kenny's meant to be tagging in on the 1st of August this year, but if Ireland make it, Mick is expected to claim that it's his right to lead them in the tournament.
And he would have a case. I mean, that was a very peculiar arrangement in the first place, but this just makes it really difficult. And the one thing is, you can rely on the FAI to, you know, deal with it competently, because they're famously well organised and diligent when it comes to sorting out administrative and legal messes and financial messes.
So Sean says, what players are happy that it's Euro 21 and not Euro 20, and which are sad, brackets Pickford, that the Euros are not this summer? Maybe it gives Pickford a bit of time to get his form back, you know, another season. Nick Ames has written a piece saying, look, it's great news for Kane and Rashford.
It is good news for England. I mean, in the least of all possible important things, England were looking like having a shambles of the Euros, despite having quite a good squad. But loads, you know, Sterling maybe can get his form back. Yeah, Rashford and Kane can get fitness back. Pickford can get his form back. Eric Dyer maybe can remember he's a footballer. All that kind of thing. But, I mean, who cares? Jesus, I mean.
It's so funny, as you mentioned Eric Dyer, just how recently, you know, the story was Eric Dyer walking up some steps or over some chairs to check his brother was all right.
Still not been charged by the FA yet. FA still haven't done anything about that.
God, the FA are just really dragging their heels on everything important, aren't they? Perhaps good news for Erling Braut Haaland, Martin Ødegaard as well. These youngsters will get another year of football. Maybe the Netherlands, Nick says, could come together a bit more. But bad news for Belgium, because they're all so old. And for Luka Modric and Cristiano Ronaldo, another season.
Yeah, well, and Messi as well. The Copa America being hosted in Argentina, he'll be another year older.
And from Derby,
I mean, also Lautaro Martinez will be another year older, might be with him at Barcelona by then, so who knows.
Doug says, are you worried that the extra year of rest is going to help Croatia not be tired? There's a conference, the Premier League are having a conference call as we speak between the representatives of all the 20 clubs, who are expected to push for a solution to finish the season ideally by the 30th of June. They'll be discussing whether the 4th of April is a realistic target to restart games. I mean, you do wonder who is in this meeting and how do they possibly know whether, for example, they might be able to play games behind closed doors and or at neutral venues. So this idea that came out was that you would have more than one game at a stadium in a day, perhaps three games in the same stadium. It'd be a neutral stadium, so that cuts the number of medical workers that are needed, and it reduces the chances of lots of fans congregating outside. It's behind closed doors. They broadcast every single one of, I think there are 92 games remaining. it sounds strange, and there's part of me that wants us to come out of this with full stadiums and hope and joy on a balmy July night, but actually the desperation for football, if you can do it, might be so much that this will be a real fillip for people.
I think it's a daft idea, to be honest.
Well, there we are.
Personally, I just don't see the point of playing elite level sport if no one's allowed to watch it. That's what it's for.
No, but they'd be watching it on telly, though, wouldn't they?
If you put 10 minutes of Bournemouth Brighton on this Saturday evening, it would be the most watched TV broadcast in the history of this country.
Yeah, I don't think you should underestimate the sort of palliative value that watching sport has. I mean, you know, obviously, the only way you could do this is if you could literally test every single person who's going to be in that stadium. At the minute, it doesn't seem like we have a testing capacity to do that. But if that does become possible, it does seem to a plausible way of... Mm-hmm. Of getting something on that people
and then
watch.
And then what? If one of your players has it, then what? Because
that's
it's done, right?
The whole issue with starting again. If somebody gets it, then you have to stop again. Because under what circumstances could you continue playing football if somebody in the game?
Yeah, you can't just be out with corona like you're out with a thigh strain, can you? Because the whole squad has to self isolate.
Right. Everybody needs to be tested and everybody needs to be all clear. Or there needs to be some kind of proven immunity, which, as you know, a qualified epidemiologist, I'm sure is an actual thing, right?
Peter says, with the government about to declare martial law, all I can think of is a TV drama featuring Anthony Martial as a maverick French lawyer with a bad attitude. What other shows can the pod get out of?
Or maybe with Dennis Law.
Absolutely right, yes.
Two of them could go around solving crimes.
Maybe they could be the rivals for Ancelotti and Duncan Ferguson, who are presumably isolating together. We can only hope. Right, the Football League. The EFL has announced a £50 million package to help clubs during the COVID-19 crisis, have listed a set of five objectives for the organisation. Ensure the health and well-being of our club's employees, supporters and communities. Make a positive contribution to the UK's efforts to tackle coronavirus. Protect the EFL's financial model and club finances. Enable the EFL to continue to function as a business. Deliver a successful conclusion to the 2019-20 season. The National League is now suspended play until at least April the 3rd. Barnet are laying off all non-playing staff as they can't afford to keep them employed with no matchday revenue coming in. Their owner, Tony Kleanthis, told David Conn, "I'm not looking for a handout from Premier League clubs, but they have a duty to football. They've enjoyed their billions for many years, so maybe for 1 year they need to say they are not spending their money on massive players' wages and are stepping in for football itself. What form that takes, I leave up to them." Jack Pitbrook's on a piece in The Athletic saying the cost of the National League rescue plan is £17 million, enough money to keep all 68 clubs solvent until the summer. The National League are going to take it to the FA this week. I mean, it's a big question about what sport as a whole will look like when this is over, right?
Yeah, I mean, I suspect this will accelerate a process that was happening anyway, and we will end up in most sports with fewer clubs, fewer bigger clubs. That was the way we were going, and I don't really see... Yeah, I just think that will accelerate us towards that, that the clubs lower down who are struggling, you know, will fade away.
This was always the issue with English football in particular, that this is private money, and in many cases it's not even sort of UK private money. I mean, you can't... under what circumstances can you tell the Glazer family to put £5 million into this pot and, you know, to help out, you know, Cambridge United, for example, or you know, MK Dons or Scunthorpe?
Do you think in any way there's a moral obligation? If you look at, I don't know, players that come from lower league that...
Of course there is. Of course there is. Because we're all, you know, any sport, any society is an ecosystem in which we're all interdependent. And I have zero faith in British society kind of recognising that we're all sort of interconnected and somehow, you know, recognising our mutual duty to each other. I have nearly zero faith, but not quite zero faith, that football, under pressure from supporters, under pressure from hopefully the media, could be persuaded to do something adjacent to the right thing. I don't know how this works in practice, because obviously 5 million to the Glazers at United is not the same as 5 million to, you know, the Norwich or Dealey Smith at Norwich. But what I think is possible is that some sort of contingency fund will be put in place. But because football clubs are run by investors looking for a profit, they will want something for that money. And whether it's some sort of strategic partnership where you say, right, we are going to put this money into the sort of half a dozen local clubs in our community, but we will, you know, we will train your young players. And obviously there's now an informal relationship. And so essentially you've created a sort of client club where the sort of the half a dozen clubs in the greater Manchester area that are now Vitesse Arnhems for Manchester City or Manchester United. I don't think that's totally out of the question. And maybe that's the only way of saving a lot of local clubs. I don't know.
Right, that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll talk to Nicky Bandini, discuss the situation in Italy. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Let's start off by discussing the situation in Italy. We'll talk to Nicky Bandini. Nicky, what is the current status there?
It's tough. I mean, it really depends. Sort of different parts of the country are feeling this much worse than others. You know, my uncle has probably smartly got away to the countryside where him and my dad are from originally. But certainly in cities like Bergamo, Bergamo in particular, really, but the northern cities in general, they're suffering at the moment. It's really, really hard. A lot of people are dying and people are stuck inside, and it's not an easy time at all.
We caveat almost every question on the pod with it's only football, but what are Serie A saying?
Serie A, in perfect continuation of the usual modus operandi, even when there's a major crisis going on, have found things to argue about. Lazio are agitating, or had been agitating, to get dispensation to allow them to get players back in training as of next week. There have been sort of various video conferences and telephone conferences between the owners of the Serie A clubs trying to decide what to do next. Of course, several clubs are currently in full lockdown because players have contracted coronavirus. I think it's now 7 players at Sampdoria who have been diagnosed with COVID-19. Some players at other clubs as well, definitely Fiorentina, a couple of others. So this idea that that you could resume training on Monday, which Lazio were keen to do, it's very sort of, it's not only a very questionable choice in terms of public health, it's also a choice that has provoked reaction from clubs to say, well, we can't, we're still on lockdown, so that's a competitive advantage. And so you have this sort of bickering going on, which feels particularly unseemly given the national picture where, again, you know, a lot of people are dying.
You wrote a piece about Lazio, you mentioned Lazio, about how the last time a Serie A season was interrupted, it was Lazio again, who are in a similar situation.
Yes, and this is the thing. And Lotito is doing a good job of making himself and his club not especially easy to feel warmly towards when you get into those sorts of arguments, like I just outlined. On the other hand, Lazio are a team that have a history which they feel still some resentment about. In 1914-15, it's the only Serie A season ever to have been suspended mid-season. Of course, there was a stoppage for the Second World War as well, but that happened in between seasons rather than actually halting a season. So in 1915, you had this slightly messy picture in Italy where there wasn't one national league, but there were different regional leagues. And Lazio had won their mini league and then won a sort of a follow-on league to be the sort of champions of the centre of Italy. In theory, they still had to play a team from the south of Italy for the right to face the best team from the north of Italy, because the north of Italy had all the best teams at that time. The playoff to decide who the champion of the south was going to be got annulled because of illegal player registration. So it wasn't entirely clear, because again, it's 1915 and documents aren't very well kept, what exactly was going to happen with that and whether Lazio were going to get a buy or if they were going to have to still play this team, but they just didn't know who yet. Meanwhile, the northern section, Genoa, were top of it, but still had a game to play against Torino, who had beaten them 6-1 earlier in the season and who could overtake them. And this is the point at which everything stops. Now, of course, it's the First World War. It's a great war. It's a much bigger societal moment than football. No one really even thinks about football for a few years. So in 1919, the Italian Football Federation awarded the title by some directive to Genoa, which is a peculiar choice given that Genoa had not actually even, as I just mentioned, had not even won the northern section yet, let alone won the grand final. But of course, again, the war has just ended. No one's really thinking about football too much. It kind of passes unnoticed. But subsequently, years later, and after it sort of been, again, another 2 years after that gets made official by a sort of confirmation ceremony run by Gazzetta dello Sport in 1921. Lazio suddenly go, well, hey, actually, we were trying to win a title and we feel quite aggrieved about this. And this has bubbled along under the surface. It hasn't been talked about all the time, but it's come up again really recently before coronavirus was a thing in Italy and in Europe. You had a lawyer in Rome submitting documents to the Italian Football Federation basically saying, I want this title from 105 years ago reassigned so that Lazio can have it shared with Genoa. To me, it's of course ridiculous. It's 105 years old. Even if you're going to make the argument that Genoa shouldn't have it, I don't see why Torino shouldn't have a claim to it, given that they still had to play Genoa, could have overtaken them, already beat them. There is something to be said for the fact that, in terms of Lazio's claim, they had been in the last two grand finals and had lost them 9-1 and 6-0 because the teams in the north were that much better at the time. So it's a slightly questionable idea that they would have gone on to win this title. But it does feel, nevertheless, and certainly is being picked up by people, Lazio fans, and indeed people at the club have been talking about it as this greater narrative that Lazio, who've won the Scudetto twice in their history, are at risk in what has been an amazing season for them. And they really were playing well this season, at risk of having another shot at the title taken away from them.
And is there an Italian version of Karen Brady who wants the season to be annulled?
There's certainly voices like that. Look, it's really messy at the moment what people want. Some people stand to benefit if the season would get annulled. In general, most people still, and I think this is the same in England, to be honest with you, but most people still want the season to get finished. And Giuseppe Gravina, who is the head of the Football Federation, and at the moment feels a little bit like the grown-up in that room, because the league and the clubs are not all acting with collective responsibility. He has been sort of highlighting all the different ways that things can go and trying to work out ways that the season can get finished. Obviously, the postponement of Euro 2020 creates fresh opportunities. For now, the directive on lockdown, for now things are suspended until April the 3rd, and that's when people are under quarantine as well. In reality, I think nobody is any more thinking it's going to be realistic to resume games before early May. But with Euro 2020 being postponed, there is theoretically enough time that you could get the league games done in June and potentially into July. Now, that is another conversation because, of course, players' contracts end on the 30th of June, so that would have to be worked out. And Gravina, again, the Football Federation president, he has sort of floated the idea publicly in the last couple of days of whether or not, first of all, player contracts being modified so that they could play into July, and then also the idea that some players might need to take a pay cut because right now clubs are struggling financially. That has been not rejected out of hand by the Football Association, but as you can imagine, that's yet another fight that is going to become a lot more complicated as it goes forward. And there's so many layers. I keep thinking as I say this, none of this can be exclusive to Italy. It's going to be the same in England, it's going to be the same in Spain, everywhere else. But there's so many layers to this because you have tickets that have been sold for games and whether or not those have to be refunded to people and whether or not insurance will pay out to clubs. You have players who are not currently working and what is the responsibility of the clubs to pay them and what is the responsibility of, again, insurance companies to step in and pick this up. What does a pandemic constitute greater forces, which a lot of these contracts have those sorts of terminology written into them, force majeure and how that impacts on things. There's a lot of actual legal stuff that's going to come into play at some point here. But for now, the expectation is that the clubs are going to confirm on, I can't remember if it was Saturday or Sunday, but in the next couple of days, there's going to be a confirmation of a decision by the clubs to not let anyone go back to training, despite Lotito's desires, until April the 3rd, the original date for the lockdown to end. So that's the expectation at the moment, but everything is still pretty fluid.
Nikki, thanks so much for coming on.
Anytime.
Nikki Bandini there.
Do you want another bonkers example from Italy?
Oh, yeah, please.
I think this remains true. So the 1927 title wasn't awarded because Torino had been found to have match-fixed and Bologna finished second, but because the Bologna owner or president was also the owner of the president of the league. He didn't want to give the title to Bologna because he thought that would look, you know, as if he was showing favouritism.
Oh, how selfless.
So I think the 27 title remains vacant. But then in 1964, Bologna and Inter finished level at the top of the table. And they hadn't invented goal difference at that point. Yeah, as Nicky said, Italy has this habit of having ludicrous arguments rather than having things laid out to kind of tell you how to do things, like goal difference. So they ended up having a playoff, which Bologna won 2-0, which was the last time they won the league. But one of the solutions to this, rather than having to have a playoff, was, oh, we'll give this title to Inter, and Bologna can have that one from 1927. We should have given them that.
I like that idea. And what about when...
Sorry, at the risk of sounding extremely pedantic, you can't invent goal difference. It's there. You just use it, or...
Well, they hadn't started to apply it, and nor did it seem... I mean...
They just hadn't noticed it was...
How could you not notice?
Like, well, a 6-0 is the same as a 1-0.
The same day that they had a playoff for the title, which was in Rome, there was a playoff for relegation held in Milan. So there was a playoff for 15th and 16th place, would that be? Yeah, 18-team league, 3 go-downs. Yeah, a playoff for 15th and 16th because they hadn't started using...
Was it because, obviously, Italian football was just so famously negative that every result was 1-0 was one nil, and that was it? Obviously, you know, the pandemic is different to war, but the war has got in the way of football before in some quite weird ways.
Well,
or weird in the sense that football has carried on during wars.
And I think this sort of touches on what we were saying before about the palliative effect of sport, that when... I mean, I was sort of really surprised when I looked at this for the Second World War. I'd sort of assumed that there'd been chaos. But actually, most leagues just kept going. We finished in England after 3 games, so Blackpool presumably are still campaigning to win that title. The true invincibles, three wins out of 3 that season. And yeah, obviously, because it was 3 games in, nobody sort of thought that should somehow stand or anything. But I mean, in Germany, it kept going through to 1945 when the US invaded. Italy, as Nicky said, I think it was kept going to 43 and then picked up again for 45-46. It was 2 seasons when there's no champion.
Did players get dispensation then?
Well, I mean...
Who was playing?
I guess that probably depend on the country-by-country basis.
Wasn't women's football incredibly popular here during the...
During the First World War, it was.
Was the First World War.
One of the reasons why I was banned from men's grounds was because there was a sense that it had become too popular and displaced the men's game. But you get some really odd things. So Hungary, for instance, football just kept going. Right through the war, even though it's occupied twice, first by the Germans and then by the Soviets, Hungarian football never stops. So, this is a plug for my book, let's be honest. The name said long ago, recently available in paperback and still available. There's a coach called Geza Curtis, who had coached in Italy before the war. And he'd gone back and he was coaching Wiepest, which is after MTK was forced to close down for being a Jewish club. Wiepest and Ferencváros were the two biggest teams left in Hungarian football. And yeah, he's coach of one of the two big teams. But he's also working with a sort of group of sports people helping protect Jews and communists and also informing on German troop movements to the US authorities. So they were in contact with the OSS, the foreign of the CIA. And Wiepest, this is in the beginning of December of 44, Wiepest had a derby against Ferencváros coming up at the weekend. And I think it's on the Wednesday he gives a press conference looking ahead to the game. And it's the most banal, normal press conference you can imagine, where he's sort of talking about, centre midfield's got a bit of a hamstring, but if he's not fit, you know, the right back can step into midfield. Yeah, he's done it before, we're not too worried. We're ready for this game. And they are the most absolute boilerplate manager quotes before a big game. And that night he gets arrested by the Gestapo and he's executed on February the 6th.
That's madness.
And so when these quotes are published in the paper, he's already been with the Gestapo for 12 hours. And so they're the most weirdly moving, almost their banality makes them more moving. The contrast between the normality and the utter horror. One of the many great tales in my new book.
I was going to say, while we're on your new book, Wilson, do you think in all this time, Barry, if I read the whole of Inverting the Pyramid, will you read the whole of it? And then we'll talk to Wilson about it.
I don't have a copy of it, but...
I mean, they do sell them still, or I can maybe help out there.
I would imagine that's one of the products that's being panic bought by the public.
If only.
We need toilet paper, nappies, and copies of Inverting the Pyramid.
Producer Jonathan has a signed copy from before the time he worked in the media, when he met Jonathan at a Blizzard event.
I'm touched.
Right.
I was at a pub quiz with Jonathan Wilson, actually, and I won a prize in the raffle, and the prize was, I think, two of your books. I think it was the Liverpool one, and I can't remember what the other one was. I put them on my pile of books, you know, ready for, which has been steadily growing for the last few years, and waiting for an opportunity to read them. And I think maybe now some lucky family in my local neighbourhood may get the chance.
Do you know what? I actually was looking through books this morning. We were going to take some to my wife's school, and I've got some other book, Barcelona something or other.
Barcelona Legacy.
Put it in the I'm going to keep it and read it pile.
Oh.
So therefore you should be... And if I give it away, they won't buy it. I can't imagine they were going to buy it anyway, but you never know. Producer Jonathan says, he told you his name, you said spelled the right way, and then he said, good lad. There we are. What a moving story. Right, that'll do for part two. Part three will begin in Australia. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. A question from Porkbeard, who says, what are the thoughts on Australia's decision to A, continue actual football, and B, start a new season of the AFL? Let's ask Jonathan Howcroft, Guardian Australia reporter over in Melbourne. Jonathan, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Just beginning the slow decline into social isolation.
Absolutely,
and,
yeah.
And still enjoying some live sport.
So how is it over in Australia?
It's peculiar. It feels like Australia is a little bit behind the rest of the world in the exposure to the coronavirus. And as a consequence of that, there doesn't really feel like there's yet the necessary level of alert in the general population that you might hope. And the government advice still is we want to flatten the curve as it is around the world. But they're refusing to really come down hard on actually preventing anything from happening. So schools are still open, for example. And their advice to the major sporting competitions like the A-League is you can continue, but you have to play behind closed doors because gatherings of over 100 aren't allowed. But it means that competitions can run if they can figure out how to do it all behind closed doors.
And is everybody happy with that? You know, players and managers happy with that? How do fans feel about it?
It's a real mixed bag. There are a lot of people who are wondering what on earth is going on. But specifically with regards to the A-League, it's really on a financial knife edge. The competition is very peculiarly run at the moment. It's in the process of decoupling from Football Federation Australia. It's a bit like the Premier League was in 1992, but they haven't fully broken away. So the clubs effectively run the competition, but it's still attached to the governing body. And everybody's just waiting for formal advice about what to do. And in the absence of that, they're just kind of muddling through. But they've got no money. The clubs themselves generally make a loss. The governing body doesn't have a rainy day fund to prop up what's going to happen in the coming weeks. And the broadcast partner, which is Fox Sports, which have underwritten the competition for a number of years, they're desperate to get out. So the fear is that if the clubs decide that they can't play, that the broadcaster would use that as their opportunity to exit a deal that they don't want to be in. So everybody's kind of, it's a standoff, really. So football kind of has to happen, otherwise the whole game could disintegrate.
Mm. I, over here, it was sort of business as usual until Mikel Arteta got it, and then other players started self-isolating. Do you anticipate it will take a manager or a player to get it before it gets suspended? Or
I think that's perfectly logical. And Dr. Peter Bruckner, who used to work with Liverpool and has been with Cricket Australia for a long time, he came out a few days ago and said, look, it's inevitable, it's going to happen. Why are we waiting until that moment to take action? And it's difficult because everybody's waiting for somebody with more authority than them to tell them to stop doing something. The PFA over here is very influential and they've been very measured in their response. You get the sense that they're not very happy, but they're going along with it. And another factor to throw into the mix is that the A-League is Australian, but one of the teams is in New Zealand. It's Wellington Phoenix, who Stephen Taylor plays for, Gary Hooper plays for, and there are travel restrictions. Australia has effectively closed its borders. New Zealand has closed its borders. So Wellington will be based in Australia for the remainder of the season while it's being played behind closed doors. And that means that they're not going to be around their families during this time. I don't know what it's like for you guys, but in times like this, you bring people that you care about as close as possible and hold them close. You don't want to be a 3 or 4 hour plane ride and 2 weeks of quarantine away from them. So that it's a very difficult situation to actually come to terms with from their perspective.
Yeah, that sounds madness. I mean, you obviously hold them close, but at a safe distance. Don't you? Barry.
Jonathan, in the absence of sort of anything resembling leadership from the government, football over here has sort of decided to cancel itself. And Wayne Rooney wrote quite a surprisingly powerful piece in the Sunday Times saying, you know, that it was footballers need to be looked after as well and that they can catch it too. What's the Australian government been like in dealing with this crisis?
So the biggest message that the Australian government has put out in comparison to the rest of the world, as I've seen it, is they're playing a 6-month timetable. So all of their modelling, all of their projections about what the curve looks like is based on a 6-month approach. And as a consequence of that, they're reluctant to be too drastic too early in case that provokes a second spike or it sets in motion so many so much isolation that there's a longer term detrimental impact to it. And the A-League is only a few weeks away from concluding, and Sydney FC are a long way ahead at the top of the table. So you can see an argument which is, okay, let's just get through one round, two rounds, maybe three, by which point Sydney might have the title sewn up, in which case, if everything else has to be mothballed, so be it. We've got part of the season out of the way. But there isn't that either decisive, okay, here a player or somebody within the football community has contracted the virus and therefore everything has to stop, nor is there the precautionary everybody has to down tools for the community benefit. So, yeah, everything just muddles on in the meantime.
Jack says, now the A-League is just about the last football there is to talk about. Will your preview of this weekend's Sydney derby take up part one or part two of the pod? So Sydney FC are top. And who are they playing? Are they playing Western Sydney Wanderers? Is that the game?
Yes.
Oh, right.
That's right.
Who are pretty hopeless.
Well, they have been pretty hopeless, but they sacked Marcus Babbel, who you'll be very familiar with in the January transfer window, or the mutual termination window, as we call it over here, because there are now transfers within the A-League. A-League clubs can sell players abroad, but there's no transfer fees within them. And Marcus Babbel was given the boot, and his replacement has actually done quite well. During that transfer window, they got Simon Cox, who is been around a few clubs in England and done reasonably well. And he's had a good impact since he came in. But Sydney have been the best team for a number of years now. Their previous coach has gone on to coach the Australian national team. Adam Lafondra has scored an awful lot of goals. But earlier this season, Western Sydney have won the two previous derbies. So you'd think Sydney FC would be going in clear favourites, but Western Sydney have got the wood over them. But you'd think with the season coming so close to its conclusion and the need for Sydney FC to get over the line as quickly as possible, that they'd do it. If there are any of the listeners watching who haven't seen Australian football very much before, Sydney FC's got a number 10 called Miloš Ninković, who's the best player in the competition, probably been the best player for a number of years and may well be the best player that the competition's ever seen. So if you are looking for an individual to focus on and get a handle on how the game is played, just keep an eye on him in Sydney FC's team. Sydney FC are in sky blue, Western Sydney are in red and black hoops.
And finally, and most importantly, did you once have an argument with Jonathan Wilson at a party about the qualities of Stuart Broad?
I absolutely have not. But
Wilson, you just make that up.
I'm happy to have imagined that I was. No, I would have been delighted to have met you.
I wonder who that was.
Do you know who Jonathan Wilson had a row about the qualities of Stuart Broad, Jonathan? I mean, it's a mystery, and we have 3 months at least to find out.
I mean, there are a lot of Jonathans in sport at the moment, aren't there, particularly in Guardian circles, so you know, it could be any one of us.
But Jonathan, he was definitely also a man from the Northwest,
right?
And then the key thing to take away from this is that I was correct. Broad had sort of started destroying Australia on a regular basis.
Was he anti-Stuart Broad?
Yeah, very much so. I thought he was very ordinary.
Right. Interesting.
Is that a view you've ever held, Jonathan?
I went through a period of being not anti-Stuart Broad, but I felt like he was there was an entitlement to his place in the team, which I don't think was always warranted. But I think in the last few seasons, he's absolutely been he's been outstanding.
Yeah, I suppose he does. You know, he's not consistent, is he? He has great spells.
Well, he's become a lot more consistent, I think, in the last couple of years.
That's the thing. The rap against him was that he would have one great test a summer, and then one great test in a series, and then he would sort of coast for a few tests. But he's actually added a huge amount of consistency to his game. He's cut his pace. He's remodeled his action, and I think he's England's best bowler in the last Ashes series. Never mind Jofra. I think Broad was definitely the most consistent.
Yeah, I'd love to talk about this for the rest of the night. I mean, Stuart Broad as a personality has come out a lot as well, hasn't it? That I can imagine being in that argument that I wasn't involved in, but I would have loved to have been in. At the time, putting myself in that place, thinking that his character would have counted a lot against him, whereas now he's so open and just such a great representative of that very personable England cricket team.
Jonathan, listen, thanks so much for coming on. We'll almost certainly call you back when we're going through each of... when we do the Mark Elam special.
Stan Lazarides retrospective.
Was Alan Mullally any good? We'll do all of those. Stay safe, and thanks for coming on.
Thank you very much.
Jonathan Hocroft, Guardian Australia reporter, positive things have come out of Corona. We're calling it Corona Positivity Corner. And in one of the breaks, Johnny, you pointed out this is not necessarily the best title for this, but we've started with it.
It's not the two words you really want in close proximity to each other, coronavirus and positive.
You're right. So. But there are some, you know, the football family is coming together. You know, Chelsea have announced they'll be accommodating NHS staff at the Millennium Hotel, which is connected to Stamford Bridge, with Roman Abramovich footing the bill. That arrangement is initially for 2 months, potentially longer. Gary Neville and Ryan Giggs are closing down the two hotels they own in Manchester, offering the rooms to the NHS for free. They'll also be continuing to pay their staff and their full salaries, and none will face redundancy. Zlatan has set up an online fundraiser with a target of €1 million, pledged €100,000 himself to support hospitals and medical staff in Italy. I mean, I guess it's a version of Common Goal, right? Footballers, a lot of them have a lot of money, but they don't necessarily have to do good things. We should at least take a minute to salute their goodness, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's particularly important, something, you know, the Gary Neville initiative, because it is showing how businesses as a whole, not just footballers, can you know, can potentially give something back.
I mean, lots of people are doing nice things, and lots of people are behaving appallingly. And it's sort of, some people are good and some people are really selfish, and that's the way of the world, I suppose. But yeah, certainly a hat tip to anyone who's helping out those in need at this time.
Another potential source of positive news is the Chinese Super League. It was meant to start on the 22nd of February. It was postponed back in January when the outbreak was beginning in China. Some teams who were in pre-season training in Europe are leaving here because of the conditions and travelling back to China because it's safer there. When they land back, they'll have to go through a 14-day quarantine. The Chinese FA are expecting the season to get underway on the 18th of April. The fact that this league is saying it's going to get started is a sign of hope that we can cling to.
Oh, and if it actually can get started, then that's hugely positive news, because it means this threat of the second wave appears to have somehow been reduced or eradicated.
Does anybody want to play? Do you know anyone who's in the Chinese Super League currently? Anyone playing right now?
Oscar.
Correct.
Graziano Pellet.
Correct. Wonderful hair. Anyone else on my list? Salomon Rondon's over there, isn't he? Paulinho.
Salomon Rondon's the best footballer in the world.
Isn't he just? What was the caveat?
It wasn't a caveat. What I said very, very clearly was, playing that lone striker role 30 yards removed from his teammate, he is the best footballer in the world. The fact that
we took it out of context.
Yeah.
There we are. Miranda's there. Hulk is still kicking about in China. Marek Hamsik, Stefan El-Shaarawy, Adair. Is he the one who scored the winner in the
2016
in the Euro final? Marko Arnautovic.
Forgot about him.
Christian Basogog, player of the tournament.
Cameroonian, yeah.
In the African Cup of Nations in 2017.
Diminutive left winger.
Yeah. And Tyus Browning, moved from Everton last year.
He was on loan at Sunderland. Rubbish.
All right, then. So without any football, we've been having some ideas of what to do on the pod, and some of you have suggested ideas along this line, is to watch a classic football match, give you the link to it that you can watch on the internet, and then we will talk about that game. And we've got a few choices. The first game we're going to go for, so we on Monday will, for some part of the pod, look back at England v Argentina. Don't want to give away the result if you don't know it. In Mexico, 86. Do we have any memories of that the first time round without giving away the result, Wilson?
Well, yeah. I think it was on BBC One. BBC Two at the same time. There was a deeply tedious interview with Ronnie Corbett from a Scottish golf course. So Ronnie Corbett at Carnoustie or Troon or Glen Eagles or somewhere. And there was a bizarrely long row in the house as to which we were going to watch.
And what was the result?
Tell you the result.
No, not the result
of the row.
I think it ended up with me and my dad watching the football downstairs and my mum watching Ronnie Corbett upstairs.
Right. So what we could do is, as well, if anybody, we'll put out the link for the game, and then I'll try and find an interview with Ronnie Corbett. And if anybody wants to watch that instead, they absolutely can. So look, we'll put that link in on the webpage. We'll tweet it out as well. And if you want to come prepared for Monday's pod, find the time to watch the entirety of England versus Argentina in Mexico 86. Jerry says, hi, Max. Jerry, who met at the live show in Dublin, we embarrassed his children throughout the whole the whole show. How about you write a serial version of your Detective Wilson novel, reading a couple of paragraphs per show as an added incentive to listen to the next show? The real Wilson could voice the character's words. I see Barry as the sardonic sidekick, i.e.
Barry's
staying... Barry's the corpse currently in this.
Plays the corpse very, very well.
He really does. Can we think of any podcasts that have been successful with someone reading out a terrible book and others laughing along?
Well, Dickens books were all serialised, weren't they, to begin with, in magazines?
Most 19th century novels were, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, oh, look, listen, I'll write chapter two.
But you need to end each one on a cliffhanger.
Oh, I'm happy to. We know the first cliffhanger, don't we? Anyway, maybe we'll read that out on Monday. Paul, what are your thoughts on doing the live pod via Skype? A live one. I'm thinking Baz in his underpants drinking cans, shooting his water gun from his place, Max and his wife cooking in Trevor Nelson's microwave, Wilson barricaded into the history section of a library. We'll obviously start remote podding. I haven't thought about live. Would you like to video live, Barry?
I'm not very good with technology, so if it's doable, I'm happy to do it. Look, nothing is off the table.
Brenaldinho says, do you agree that giving a week's free trial of Football Manager 2020 is both a terrific gesture and at the same time a bit like giving free samples of crack to people who are involuntarily cold turkeying from crack?
It's a very good gesture to, you know, I'm sure it will have a marketing benefit as well, but fundamentally it's a lovely gesture. But I have to say, I find Football Manager now is just too complicated. Give me the 0102. That's my level.
I'm Championship Manager 93. That's even brilliant goal for Cambridge, slotted through a crowd by Mick Heathcote, but it won't count. The reason isn't clear. He waves away the protests.
I'm with Wilson here. I think they've got far too complex. You know, doing like individual training schedules and you know, it's almost like, I mean, I much prefer the arcadey version of the 90s. It's like the game Operation became more and more complex each year, and now you literally have to complete thoracic surgery.
8 hours.
Yeah. Well, there's a new update available.
I play quite a lot of Crusader Kings 2.
Yes, Lars asked you about that.
Yeah, yeah. And the problem with that is that the game I'm currently playing, I've had two very successful crusades. I have an enormous amount of land, which means there's a phenomenal amount of admin. And it's just starting it up, there's this sort of great sense of dread of kind of, oh God, it's going to take me hours just to go through kind of sorting out the tax revenues. And
just go back to Chucky Egg. It's more straightforward.
Am I the only person on the planet who's never played Football Manager?
Hmm. Maybe you are. I don't think my wife's played it.
Yeah.
Probably the only football fan.
Am I? Yeah.
Why don't we start a season? We can just have it going in the corner of the room.
Championship Manager?
Pardon?
Championship Manager?
No.
Premier Manager?
No.
Virtua Soccer?
No.
On the Ball? That had six
And then Hughes International Soccer?
Oh, I tried Pro Evo on the PlayStation, but hated it. Okay. It was too hard.
Oh, I've played quite a lot of that against Miguel last Sunday.
Really? Sensible Soccer?
No.
We did a like, classic teams. So you know you have to download them and everything, and we end up just getting loads of abuse for not including Arsenal's Invincibles.
Well, listen, there is still Twitter abuse out there. I know that for certain. Barry, question for you: if you had to stay on a desert island, self isolate with a companion, would you choose Jonathan Wilson or Wilson the volleyball from Castaway?
I'd go Jonathan.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I was rather hoping you'd choose the people.
Sorry, mate.
Jose says, hey, guys, big fan of yours in the US. Due to the coronavirus, I'm driving from Florida to Massachusetts this weekend, about 1,300 miles. Thursday's pod will occupy some of that. I'll take a shout out if you've got one for me from an Everton fan. Hello to you, Jose. Have a safe trip. Burnvan 3000 says, not sure how far you're scraping the barrel, but best, most absurd football-related dream everyone's had would interest me. I once dreamt that Jordy Cruyff was naturalised to play for England and started in the holding role for Steve McClaren. Didn't you have a dream once you got lost at the Majewski Stadium?
Was that me?
I don't know. You had to play. In my memory, you came in one Sunday, I think, to the radio, and you said, I've had a dream that I was turning out for Reading, but I got lost.
Oh, that rings a bell.
I'm just here for your memory now, Barry.
Reading fans would be very pleased that I got lost and wasn't able to play.
Conrad said, how is Archie's love life? Has there been another date since Monday? I think we all need a feel-good story right now. Hashtag Team Archie. For those of you who weren't listening on Monday, we had Archie out in Germany and asked him what he did at his weekend. He went on a Tinder date, which appeared to go very well. So I asked him for an update. He said, all I will confirm... parental advisory. Thank fuck she doesn't listen to the pod. Her mum once danced with Oliver Kahn at a disco, and with that, no more. And then he said, after sleeping on it, so this was this morning, you may have my opening line to her. Now no more. His first line to this lady that he's, who knows how it's going, responding to, I presume, something about music. He wrote, Beyonce, okay, the 1975, cool, but how do you feel towards the Venga Boys? So... that's flirty talk for Archie.
I reckon he's in there.
Yeah. And Mike says, can we have more Barry Glendening spoken word songs, please? No Diggity by Blackstreet. Thanks.
I don't know it.
Well, I don't know if we're committing to anything right now, but no idea is off the table. I, for one, would absolutely love to you to finish the next pod with no diggity. Producer Jonathan is shaking his head in despair. But I think give the people what they want. We'll find out. If you listening would like it, we'll give it to you. And if you won't, if you don't, we won't. It's fine. And that'll do for today's podcast. Jonathan Wilson, thank you.
Thank you.
Jonathan Liu, thank you.
Thanks.
Barry Glendenning, thank you.
You're welcome.
We'll be back in some guise on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.